Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a planetary geologist and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a great big speculative fiction nerd.
All right, so this week was my pick, and I chose a classic I remembered from my childhood, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mind you, I don't think I've seen this since I was a child, and it was quite different than I remembered. But the basic plot is this. In this Steven Spielberg movie, we're introduced to a group of people who have an encounter with a UFO. It leaves them sunburned, singing a similar song, and obsessed with a geologic formation they don't recognize. At the same time, the US government receives a radio signal with the precise coordinates to Devil's Tower in Wyoming. The government infers that the aliens would be landing there, so they evacuate the region, telling the public that there's been a toxic gas leak. A handful of folks who encountered the UFOs make their way to Devil's Tower anyway, where several abductees are returned, and they meet the aliens, communicating with them through the language of sound.
Here are the patterns. We just received two 15-minute broadcasts.
Are these non-random signals?
104 rapid pulses. After a five-second interval, 40 pulses. Another five-second break, and 30 pulses. 60 seconds of silence, and then an entirely new set of numbers. 40, break 5, 36, break 5, 10. 104 rapid pulses.
Hard.
Wait 60 seconds, and the whole doggone thing repeats.
Where are these signals coming from?
Right in the neighborhood. Light travel time roughly 7 seconds. It's well within the plane of the ecliptic.
All right. So this is a movie from 1977. As I said, I'm pretty sure I saw it as a child. So perhaps a decade after it came out. And I remember the aliens, right? Maybe this is what sparked my love of the X-Files a few years later. But really, I remember the mashed potato scene where Richard Dreyfuss is building Devil's Tower out of potatoes.
Oh, classic. So classic.
Yeah. So in rewatching this, it's really quite different than I remembered. It's not nearly as scientific as I remember. It's mostly a lot of style. You know, I think Spielberg was really excited about these special effects showing the spaceships and then later the aliens. But honestly, the plot, I'm not really sure what the plot of this movie is. I don't know what story they were trying to tell. None of the characters were particularly compelling. You know, the hero is somebody who like screams at his family and then abandons them, which is kind of a weird hero arc. And then, you know, I don't even understand what they were trying to say about the aliens and how they were talking to them or what they got out of that. Anyways, like I said, not the movie I remembered. All style and no substance. What did you think about this movie, John?
Well, I think I was a bit older when I saw it. I don't recall if I was a teenager or if it was something I saw when I was in university. But I didn't remember it all that well. Again, you know, I remember the mashed potatoes and that's about it. And rewatching it now, it was interesting, right? Because it reminds me so much of the X-Files, but it kind of reminds me of a whole bunch of X-Files at the same time, all intercut with each other, right? It has like so many pieces that don't seem to quite fit together in a coherent way. Like you were saying, more style than plot.
Yeah.
It was interesting. Enjoyable? Maybe not as much as I'd hoped.
No, it was also kind of boring. I think part of that is it went on too long. This movie is like 2 hours and 15 minutes, something like that, which is actually pretty long for a movie made in 1977. Movies tended to be shorter than 2 hours. And I do feel like they could have edited it perhaps a bit better. And it does sound like there are different versions of this movie. Spielberg had to rush to get it into theaters because, was it Columbia Pictures was like going to go bankrupt otherwise? And so he did a second cut in 1980, but he didn't like that one either. And so there's a third cut from like the late 90s. So it's not even sure what the final story he wanted to tell was, which makes it, I think, difficult to follow a bit. I did find this quote about what Spielberg at least was aiming for in this movie. He said, "I wanted to make Close Encounters a very accessible story about the everyday individual who has a sighting that overturns his life and throws it into complete upheaval as he starts to become more and more obsessed with this experience." So that's what he was aiming for. But again, Richard Dreyfuss is not a particularly empathetic lead character. As I mentioned, you know, like he treats his family like garbage. And you don't ever really get a good resolution about his obsession. I guess he goes with the aliens, right? But I don't know. I didn't find that very satisfactory in the end.
It's kind of puzzling, actually, that it's the third highest grossing movie of 1977, given all of that. People seem to be able to look past the flaws, I guess.
Yeah, I think at the time they were just really excited about, you know, UFOs and all the special effects. To be fair, though, the second highest grossing movie was a movie I've never heard of before. It was like Smokey and the Bandit or something. So, you know, at least I remember this movie as opposed to whatever.
It's all right, audience. We'll forgive her.
Of course, everyone knows the highest grossing movie of 1977 was Star Wars. It turns out that Lucas and Spielberg made a bet because neither one was quite sure how their movie was going to do. Did you read about this?
Oh, I can imagine it.
And so I think they each said, okay, well, I'll give you like 2.5% of the gross revenue of my movie just in case one of them tanks, but the other does well. So now they're just like extra super rich because both of the movies did well, I guess. So yeah, kind of a fun story there.
Well, tell you what, Catherine, why don't you tell us how you really think and let's get into the science gripes.
Yes. So as I said, this movie was not as scientific as I remember. And so my list of science gripes is longer than I was expecting. Again, I think some of this could have been fixed by plot or some exposition, and it just never came. So let's start with the first alien encounter we have. It's in rural Indiana. We see a small boy in his bedroom, and then out of nowhere, all of his toys start turning on. His record player starts going, and he leaves his house and wanders off into the forest. My question was, like, what are the aliens doing to remotely control his toys? They seem to be able to easily control Earth electricity and technology. How do they even know how it works, right? And how do they do it remotely? And as John pointed out, it seems very selective. So the toys turn on, but the lights don't. In another scene, all the lights go out in the city, but the airplanes still work. So yeah, the aliens seem very selective about what they can and cannot do. And there's no real explanation about how they do it or why they're doing it. So yeah, John, what did you think about this?
Yeah, I think my issue with this, like I didn't take it as the aliens were intentionally doing these things. It's just that the presence of their technology just had this effect on objects around it. So it was accidental. They might not even have known what they were doing. But the thing that is bizarre then is, again, that selectivity, right? The fact that so many different things happen, and they happen to some objects, but not to other objects. I mean, we have here the lights in the house not coming on, but the battery operated toys coming on. And later on, we have physical objects moving around, some, but not others. I guess just whatever Spielberg's effects department had attached something to make it go a little nuts.
Another question I didn't understand. So the boy goes into the kitchen and the fridge is open and all the food is on the floor. What caused that? Was there like an alien raiding their fridge? I didn't understand that at all.
They do talk later on about gravity, but gravity affects everything in the same way. It doesn't just affect cans of Coke.
Oh, you think they like picked up the fridge and then dropped it on the floor like they did with Richard Dreyfuss's truck?
I don't know, you know, not to jump ahead too much, but that railroad crossing just flicking back and forth by 10 feet, I can't think of a single scientific phenomenon that would have that effect on that one object, which happens to be the one thing cemented into the ground,
right,
of all of the objects around, and yet everything else is kind of unaffected. So it seemed like Spielberg was pulling more from old ghost story tropes where the ghost goes and interrupts the scene and, you know, things fly off or get disturbed wherever the ghost is a little.
Yeah, but the aliens do seem to have some control over gravity because their spaceship have no obvious propulsion, right? I think we've complained about this with other movies and television shows. Star Wars, again, being another offender. They just sort of float there. There's no obvious propulsion. They can move in weird ways that don't make a lot of sense. Like, I think you noticed something where it came in really fast and then stopped on a dime.
Yeah, you know, that raspberry jam problem, as we kind of call it. The idea that if you don't have control of gravity, you pull big G's and everybody inside just gets smashed to bits. We'll come back to this later on, but there are definitely some weird gravity scenes. I did like, though, that you do hear them a couple of times talking about weird gravity signals. So at least there's a little bit of acknowledgement there.
Mm. Oh, is that what the gravity talk was about? Yeah, they so
that was my guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
At one point, yeah, they're just saying, oh, we're looking at deviations of, 50 milligal, which is a gravity measurement. But I had no idea why they were talking about gravity. Okay, maybe that's. But again, they don't explain any of this. They're just like scientific sounding words thrown here or there with no explanation.
Oftentimes when we see these kinds of movies, there's sort of this omniscient perspective and there is all of this exposition and you get this sort of techno babble that we've talked about a few times. This one feels like it's sort of from Roy's perspective, in the sense that the prevailing sense I get through the whole movie is just utter confusion about why anything is happening the way that it is.
Oh, okay. All right. So we're seeing it from the main character's point of view, because he would probably be pretty confused. All right. Still not very satisfactory as a viewer, though, I gotta say.
No, because, I mean, even at the end, when they have the aliens coming down to that landing pad, nothing of what's happening there is explained either, which is unusual for a movie of this kind, I think.
Right. Like the big finale, the big climax is just this long drawn out. I called it a jam session between the aliens and the humans.
Yes.
They're like playing music at each other, which again, they never explained. Like, do they even know what the aliens are saying? Or are they just playing random notes at them and hoping they will one day figure out the language?
Well, the thing that tipped me off is that halfway through that whole, you know, battle of the bands, Space Jam, shall we call it? they have this one little scene where they cut away from Roy's perspective into a back room, and somebody says, okay, automatic translation taking over, and hits a button, and then the organ starts playing on its own. So it sounds like at that point, they've accumulated enough data that they understand what the aliens are saying, and they want to communicate back to them. But none of this is explained. That's my best guess.
Right. We never learn what they're saying. Right? Okay, they're automatically translating it, but into what? What are they saying to the aliens? What are the aliens saying back? Like, that would have been much more impactful if we knew what they were talking about, but they don't ever explain that. So, I mean, we'll get to this in Science Shine. I do like the idea of communicating through music. That's a neat idea, but they don't explain it in a lot of detail. And I especially was confused by the hand signs. So there's a character in the movie, a Frenchman who's meant to mimic a famous French ufologist. And he's talking to this group of, I guess, government officials about how he's going to teach them how to communicate with these musical hand signs, which I had never heard of. I guess you learned about it in elementary school. They are a real thing. They were originally invented by an English reverend to teach school children about music, but I guess then were adapted by a composer whose name I'm probably going to mess up, Zoltán Budály. And so the idea is you use a hand symbol to represent a note, very similar to how Julie Andrews taught us all to sing in The Sound of Music with Do, Re, Mi. But instead of Do, Re, Mi, you use different hand signals. Again, they never explain why they're doing this. I mean, yes, the aliens are communicating through music, but why not just use music, which is a frequency, right? As opposed to a hand signal. How would the aliens know what the hand signals are? What if they don't have hands? You know? I found this all bizarre. What did you think about this whole hand signals as a way of communicating musically to the aliens?
Well, they don't really communicate to the aliens with the hand signals. It's more that Lacombe, he has this meeting with other, I can't tell if it's politicians or scientists or who, in a really empty stadium.
Yes.
Where they only have the first couple of rows. And he spends so much time explaining the hand signals to them, which seems totally unnecessary. I mean, I did run into this in like primary or elementary school when I was a kid. I thought this was something that just all kids learned, but it seems like we only have about a 50% rate of that, at least on this podcast. So it seemed like this is a place where you could save a little time on the edit, frankly.
And again, like The Sound of Music had been out for a decade. People knew Do, Re, Mi, right? It was very mm-hmm. popular, a cultural touch point. So why are they doing the hand signals at all? If you just want to teach somebody musical notes in a simple way, use sounds, not hand signals.
Yeah, we didn't do much with that, really. I mean, we knew that the hand signals, and they corresponded to that whole, sol, fa thing. But it was not something we did much with. And I did a lot of choir as a kid, right? It was rare that we would pull that out.
So yeah, I thought that was very bizarre. And as you said, probably, again, something that could have been left out of the edit and tightened it up a bit. And so it wasn't quite as long and boring. So a bit confusing. All right, let's get back to the aliens. These aliens, again, are hard to pin down. In addition to being able to manipulate children's toys, they also seem to be able to control the weather. Whenever we see them coming in, they bring in clouds and lightning. So why are they doing that? They also seem to be very familiar with our odd latitude-longitude system. Like, they send the numbers for the location of Devil's Tower, which, mind you, are incorrect. They actually wrote them them down wrong, which is pretty funny. But how would they know that we use degrees, minutes, seconds as a way of indicating location on the planet Earth in these strange 60 seconds, 60 minutes, 180 degrees?
I know, we haven't even talked to them yet.
I know. Are they reading our minds?
Well, apparently they can implant visions. So, I mean, that seems like it's pretty sophisticated.
Yeah, maybe they are reading our minds. But yeah, these aliens just seem to be able to do everything. And again, no explanation about why they're doing it, how they're doing it. They're just magical, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Though the Earthlings, I think, have some issues as well. I mean, there are definitely some own goals early on in this movie. I think both of us caught that chase of all of the alien spacecraft that happens early in the movie. Doesn't really seem to be taking place in eastern Indiana.
No.
There's a lot of topography. There's this view down into lots of cities to the horizon with lights in one of the least populated places in the U.S., though not as unpopulated as Devil's Tower. And there are tunnels and there are toll gates at the Ohio border. I guess bring your passport or something. It seemed very bizarre.
Yeah, the tunnel scene really took me out of the movie. Like, you see tunnels in major cities, not in rural Indiana as you're driving around in cornfields. I mean, as someone who has lived in the middle of nowhere, you would never see that, right? I spent many years living on the Canadian prairies. It's just flat and agricultural. It did not represent that area well. I think it was actually filmed in Alabama, which you would also think wouldn't be terribly, have a lot of topography. So kind of curious.
Very, very strange sort of thing. And of course, when the aliens are not sending us preschool tones or when they're not implanting visions in us, they're blasting everybody with harmful levels of UV light.
Yeah. So everyone gets a sunburn, right, who encounters these aliens, mm-hmm. which you typically only get when exposed to large amounts of ultraviolet radiation, right? But why? Why would you do that? Why would you transmit UV light? I mean, white light should be sufficient and that wouldn't burn you. I don't know. I don't know why they're transmitting UV light. Maybe they think we're too pale and want us to be dark. I don't know.
Oh, it's so strange. This is where you can start to hand wave if you want. Well, maybe the aliens see in slightly different wavelengths. But I don't know. The more energy you put into light, the lower the wavelength, the higher the frequency, the more damage it does to everything around you. So you would assume they would understand trade-offs like this.
You think so. Although, yeah. I mean, wouldn't they get sunburned too? We later see them in the movie, right? And they're quite pale, but maybe they don't have melanin. So maybe UV light doesn't affect them in the same way as it does us. Anyway, it's just very bizarre. I thought the whole sunburn thing, I mean, obviously they want to use it as a marker of people who had been exposed to the UFOs, but it's a weird choice for the aliens to be irradiating us with UV light.
Moving from the uninhabited area 50 kilometers to the east of Muncie, we can jump over to Wyoming because the filmmakers did something that's always very dangerous to us here on Popcorn Science. They stated a number.
They did.
When they were talking about the area. And so whenever Catherine and I hear a number, we have to go and check that out. Do the calculation, look it up. And they talked about the number of people that they were evacuating from rural Wyoming up in the northeast corner of the state where Devil's Tower is. And I think it was 150,000 people that they were taking out of there, which is a lot of people.
In the least populated state in the country.
In the least populated part of the least populated
yes,
state.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so John, you actually looked up the population of the different counties surrounding Devil's Tower. What did you find?
I did. They had historical records of how many people lived in this. And Devil's Tower, it's located in, and these are big counties, by the way, because it's fairly unpopulated. So the one that Devil's Tower is located in is called Crook County, and that had a population of 5,000 estimated in 1977. There were too few people to properly count. And even if you then roped in the other encircling counties to Crook County, which are Campbell and Weston, you only get another 24,000 people. So less than 30,000 people live within 100 miles of this particular area, or at least did in 1977. And then you, I think, went and hypothesized, well, what if the park was just mobbed? You know, how
That's
many
right.
people came to the Devil's Tower back before Spielberg made it famous?
Right. I'm like, okay, well, I mean, it's rural Wyoming, but maybe Devil's Tower is very popular and there's a ton of tourists visiting there. And that's the 100,000 people they need to evacuate. But actually, the National Park Service also has historical records of visitors to the park. I could only go back to 1979. So these might be inflated because the park had been made famous in a movie 2 years prior. But the most popular month was July because, you know, people are on summer vacation. And they only had 63,000 visitors in that month. And clearly they all didn't come on the same day. It's not like there are 63,000 people in the park at any one time. So again, take a fraction of that, add it to the 30,000 people who lived in that region, and you're well short of 150,000 people. So I guess Wyoming was having a population surge that day for some reason. I don't know where they came up with that number.
Yeah, it seems like something just pulled out of absolutely nowhere. Very strange.
So Devil's Tower, I think, was the first national monument that was consecrated by Theodore Roosevelt. And they also got the date of that wrong. It's like they never fact-checked anything in this movie. So yeah, it was opened in 1906. But in the movie, they said it was 1915 when Roosevelt wasn't even president. So anyways, yeah, they really needed to be more careful with the numbers they used in this movie.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Anything around that kind of date, you think it would be like someone in the room had to know that there was an issue with that one. All right, tell you what, since we're over at Devil's Tower, why don't I talk about the scene with the extra G's?
Okay.
We have this lovely scene that they set up. By the way, nothing with Devil's Tower is the right size or distance or speed. We'll get to that. So there's this big wide shot after dark, and you see these meteors going by. And one of these meteors actually sort of stops and turns into the spaceships and comes right into the image, into the shot. And that is some really fast deceleration. Like, things that are in orbit are going really, really quickly. Like, we're talking kilometers per second, miles per second. If you want to put it in the kinds of units that we're more used to down here at sea level, you're talking 20, 30, 40,000 kilometers an hour, you know, fast. And that's why you get that ion trail when they come into the atmosphere that you see with a meteor. But when you're slowing down, you can only slow down so quickly without causing yourself to black out or turn into, as we say, strawberry jam. So normally it takes quite a while to get from the edge of space and to slow down to the point where you can land near the surface. And for the space shuttle, for instance, I looked this up and it's almost a half hour from 80 kilometers, you know, just at the edge of space, all the way back down. And it takes quite a bit of time for other spacecraft to do this as well, even under fairly heavy deceleration. So for the aliens to come in like a meteor and basically be at the surface moving at normal speeds in seconds, that's a really fast deceleration. It makes for a great shot, but there's some problems with that sort of thing. Now, granted, if they've got control of gravity, maybe they have some of those infamous inertial dampers that we know and love from Star Trek. But yeah, that's a little bit of a warping thing. Although I will say that, and this is a plot point on the X-Files quite frequently, is things moving in ways that seem to defy physics in the sky. Lights moving like
that's
that.
That's right. So that's right.
At least we got some consistency there. But speaking of inconsistent things, I think you noticed that different shots of the mothership, it's kind of confusing as to how big this thing is.
Well, I think their problem there was they put it right next to Devil's Tower, right? And that is a fixed size. But the mothership, as it's moving around, it seems to change in size compared to Devil's Tower, right? One point it looks much bigger than it, then it looks much smaller than it. They can't seem to get the size of this mothership correct. So, you know, when it's behind the mountain, it looks a lot bigger. When it's in front of the mountain, it's no longer bigger. And it's a shame because this is like the iconic shot from this movie, right? About the mothership hovering over Devil's Tower, and they can't even get the size right. I mean, special effects were what they were in 1977, but, you know, you could have tried a little harder to do that correctly. And then when you see the mothership, it is quite brightly lit. It's kind of a cool design, which we'll talk about later. But when it's going over the crowd there gathered at the foot of Devil's Tower, it casts a dark shadow. So, but shouldn't the lights be illuminating them, like spotlights, and not casting a shadow? So that was kind of curious. They were not very consistent with lighting or size with regard to the mothership.
That's true, because they have the shadow going along in the middle of a moonless night over near Muncie early on.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, I think we have to talk about the Space Jam session.
The Space Jam.
Oh, yes.
Not Raspberry Jam.
And then, no. We've got multiple kinds of jam in this show. Mm-hmm. So I think there were things to like about this communication with music. It is very mathematical. And there are things not to like the idea that they learned each other's language in a couple of minutes. I don't know. What did you make of this?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I thought this was ill-explained, I guess. The fact that we just didn't know what they were talking about, it left that scene sort of hollow. It was like they were just picking up random tunes and shouting at each other. Like, it wasn't even clear that they were communicating with each other. Like, the aliens could have just been mimicking the sounds we were making, thinking we were talking to them. So for the final climatic scene, it just left me feeling not as excited as you would like for a scene like that.
Well, I think I'm with you. Just speaking of that scene, I think there's just one other thing that we have to talk about, at least, and that's the fact that Spielberg actually shows us the aliens. So we have to think a little bit about alien biology here. And it's not just one kind of alien. We get a whole bunch of them. So I think you described one as like a spider or a puppet. I was thinking it was something, you know, like spider or crab like myself.
Yeah, it was a puppet. The other okay, ones were okay. Kids. They were actually all six-year-old girls, because they thought girls would follow directions better than boys. So yeah, there's two types of aliens. One is a puppet. It looks like a puppet. It appears first, and then all these little six-year-old girls in alien costumes come out, and they look different. But it's not at all clear that aliens would look like us. I know it's a trope in science fiction, the reticulan gray alien with the big head and the small body. But, you know, why would an alien look like us with four limbs that had fingers, that's able to breathe oxygen? Why are there two different types of aliens, right? Are they two different sexes or two different species? I mean, quite frankly, I wish they hadn't shown the aliens at all. So again, not to bring up the X-Files again, but I think the X-Files did this much better. They would always imply something scary rather than show it to you. And a lot of this had to do with budget. They just didn't have the money to show you the scary thing, but it made it a lot more scary and compelling, I thought, than actually showing you the alien or the monster. I think it's silly that they showed the aliens just for aesthetic reasons, but also it just introduces more questions than it answers.
Oh, I agree entirely. Like, anything in the real world cannot be as scary as what you have in your own imagination. And so many of these movies do well to hide the monster as long as possible. And speaking of monsters, we of course end the movie with the family abandoner with a great big smile on his face, getting his astronaut costume on and walking into the spaceship.
Yeah, again, why? Has he just been brainwashed by the aliens? All the other abductees seem really eager to leave. Although why they're the same age after being in space for 30 years, I don't know. Unless they were traveling at the speed of light for 30 years straight. But again, why? I'm picturing these aliens like capturing somebody on Earth, going to space, booking it at the speed of light, then turning around, coming back, picking up another person, and just like going for another joyride. There's no rationale here, right? The only reason that they would look the same is if they'd been traveling at intense speeds. But why are they doing this? Why are they picking up humans and taking them on joyrides and then returning them 30 years later? There's no rationale here. It's so frustrating.
Too much explanation in some cases, not enough explanation in others. I'll tell you what, let's drop it here. And why don't we come back in just a minute and see if we can find a few things about this movie that we actually liked. Welcome back. Now it's time for us to talk about the science shine, the things about this film that we thought were well done and that really conformed to the laws of the universe that we know. So, Catherine, was there one thing that just jumped out at you as they got this right? Thank goodness.
I mean, there's a lot of little things. I don't know if there's any big thing they really got right. I did appreciate that when they detected the signal from outer space, which I assume was just the aliens talking to them, they used a real radio telescope, which is Goldstone in California. This is a couple of different radio telescopes of different sizes. The one they were particularly talking about was Goldstone Station 14, or DSS 14, which is a real telescope used presently in the Deep Space Network, so it can talk to spacecraft at the outskirts of the solar system, like Voyager, Cassini, other spacecraft. And it's big enough. It's a 70-meter telescope and was actually upgraded in 1988 so it could communicate with the far-flung Voyager spacecraft. So I appreciated that they used a real telescope there. I haven't actually visited the telescopes myself, but I was in Barstow, California in 2023, and there's a fun little visitor center you can go to there next to a train museum. So, you know, you get telescopes and trains. Fun time. And yeah, it's still used today. I'm a member of the Mini-RF radar instrument on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and we use Goldstone to transmit signals to the moon, which we then receive with LRO after our transmitter broke in 2010. So, you know, it was cool to see a real telescope represented in this movie. I don't know. What stood out to you, John? What's your biggest science shine?
Well, I thought that was interesting as well. And it's a case where I actually learned something from the movie, because I didn't realize that Goldstone was called Echo or on the Echo site. So that was kind of neat. In terms of some of these sorts of things, like you say, it's all like little things. And I can just do a tour and hit a few of these. For the air traffic control, mm-hmm. they actually talk about flight levels properly, which was nice. When they talk about how far away the signal's coming from, 7 light seconds, that's actually reasonable. That's actually just a third again as far as JWST is, about 5 times as far away as the moon is. So, you know, it's in the neighborhood. It's not terribly far, which is totally reasonable. They talk about the size of the landing pad being about a second of arc, which is about 100 feet on the side. And that also is correct. So there's a bunch of these little things, I think, that are there. But I'm with you that there's no big arc that really feels scientific.
No, but I do have 2 things I wanted to talk about. They don't actually refer to in the movie, but I just thought the listeners might be interested to learn a little bit more about some of the stuff that's going on in this movie. So Devil's Tower, obviously, is one of the characters in this movie, I would say. Probably more interesting than some of the other characters. And it is quite an interesting geologic feature. It's become quite popular, quite well known now because of this movie. But there are many other features like it in the Western United States. It's what's, okay, I'm going to use some geology terms here. It's what's known as a laccolith. So basically, there's different ways that magma and lava can flow on the surface of the earth due to volcanism. So people are familiar with your typical cone-shaped volcano, right? Expels lava onto the surface. But a laccolith is what happens when magma comes up to the surface and gets trapped under different layers of rock and just pushes those rock upward in sort of like a pimple shape. You know, it's kind of like a pimple, right? You're injecting some fluid underneath the rock, pushing it up in this domical kind of shape. And then it slowly cools. And then the rock on top, which is often sedimentary rock, as in the case here in Devil's Tower, is more easily eroded. So it gets eroded away. And all you're left with is this igneous, this volcanic extrusion sitting at the top of the ground. And that's what Devil's Tower is. It also has some very cool columnar jointing, which you see when lava cools slowly, which it did in this case, in the presence of water. So those nice sort of streaks on the side are just these beautiful columns of basalt, and which makes it very difficult to climb, as they refer to in the movie. I guess it's a big climber's paradise there. People are always trying to climb up the side of Devil's Tower, jutting out there with these columns. So yeah, so it's a cool feature. I wish they had talked about it more. I don't know why they picked it, to be honest, but it's not the only one of its type. When John and I were in grad school, we would go on these geology field trips once a semester to all sorts of different places in the southwestern United States. And, you know, I've seen a laccolith in my day. I haven't been to Devil's Tower, but they're all over the place, right? Because volcanism happens in many different places in the western United States. So, you know, take a look around and see if you can find a laccolith when you're out rock hunting the next time.
Yeah, that columnar type of jointing is really neat. So many examples of that in places like Hawaii.
Yeah, I've seen a columnar basalt in Iceland. We even see it on Mars, which is pretty cool. One of our colleagues identified it in the wall of a crater. So yeah, as long as you have lava and you appear to need water too, we don't see them on the moon, for instance. You can get these columnar jointing. Yeah, so kind of a cool feature.
Universal physical laws. Who would have thunk it?
So the other thing that they didn't talk about in the movie, but it reminded me of it, and I guess they didn't talk about it because it hadn't happened yet, but there's this very famous detection by a radio telescope called the WOW signal, which some people think is our best evidence for contact by extraterrestrial intelligence. It was this very strong radio signal detected on August 15th, 1977. So just a few months before this movie came out. So it had already been written and filmed by then. And this was through a Big Ear radio telescope at Ohio State University. It was looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. It was specifically looking at what we call the hydrogen line, which is 1420 megahertz. This is a line at which hydrogen emits light. And so there was some thought that since everybody knows about hydrogen, it's the most common element in the universe, that aliens might try to communicate on this line. And so they were looking there, just kind of keeping their ear open for any transmissions from this frequency range. And there was this very high signal, 30 times greater than the background that popped up in August of 1977. And the person who was monitoring the signal was so impressed by the signal, he actually wrote "Wow" next to it, which is where it gets its name. So people still don't know where this signal came from. It's never been confirmed. People have looked for it in the years since, and nobody has really seen anything. So it still remains a curiosity. Are you familiar with the signal, John?
I have heard about it as well. And I think in some ways, it kind of typifies a lot of the trouble, I think, with this particular movie, right? Like, it's something that's unexplained. It's a question. And we scientists, we love our questions. But sometimes when you're talking to the public, when they see something unexplained like this, there's this jumping to conclusions, right? Like, well, if you can't explain it, then it must be, you know, aliens or a cover-up or something like that. And this is something that they get into just a little bit, right? Because of course, Spielberg doesn't want to alienate his audience. They have this conversation with the Air Force at one point in there, and they start talking about coincidence a little bit. And there's a very famous saying in science, which is that correlation is not causation. So if you see multiple things together, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily the one is causing the other. But so much of this movie actually seems to sit on top of that idea that weird things that we don't understand must be aliens to explain
it
all.
Right. And so, yeah, chances are the WOW signal is not aliens, right? There are a number of different explanations people have come up with. But when you can't point to a specific cause, it does leave people to wonder. And throughout history, we've always tried to ascribe strange things to monsters and aliens and fairies and gods. It's sort of a human tendency, I think.
Oh, definitely. And we love a story, right? We want there to be more to what we're seeing and hearing. I mean, we bring in this movie almost a little incongruously, I think, the idea of the Bermuda Triangle and planes that have been lost there, or the Cotopaxi, you know, another ship that was lost. And I hate to say it, but probably what happened is that these craft ran into trouble, something failed, and the people on them died.
Yeah.
And it's sad and it's unfortunate, but there's probably not another story to it, unfortunately.
Well, and in the case of the Cotopaxi, it was actually discovered in the 1980s and then positively identified in January of 2020. So we know where it was. We know what happened, which, as you said, is just this tragic story of people losing their lives in unfortunate conditions. We don't hear much about the Bermuda Triangle anymore, but it's just this region bounded by Florida, Puerto Rico, and Bermuda in the Atlantic Ocean. And probably it's just there was a lot of bad weather there. We didn't have good tracking. The Cotopaxi went missing in 1925, right? It wasn't using GPS or anything like that to navigate. We couldn't predict the weather as well as we can today. So you don't hear about it much anymore because people have better tools now for navigating in that region and are less likely to face these unfortunate consequences.
It's true. And even beyond this movie, like for some reason, they didn't talk about Amelia Earhart, for instance, another one of these navigational errors that probably led to an explorer, you know, simply dying, unfortunately, as opposed to, you know, all of the mysticism and all of the stories that have arisen around it.
Yeah. But I did appreciate that they were bringing out real life examples with Flight 19 and Cotopaxi, these crews that disappeared over the Bermuda Triangle. They weren't just making up things. I guess they're implying the Bermuda Triangle is where aliens like to kidnap people. It seems like a weird place to do that since there aren't a lot of people living in the Atlantic Ocean. But I guess that was what their explanation was. Just one other thing. I did also kind of like the design of the mothership. I don't know if you agree with me or not, John, but you know, so often you see UFOs as just these very smooth kind of disc-like objects, which is not really in keeping with what actual spacecraft look like. I mean, if you look at the International Space Station, it's got all sorts of stuff hanging off the side, you know, radiators, solar panels, sensors. It's not aerodynamic because why would it? It's meant to be in space. So I think it was cool the mothership had all these sort of pipes and contraptions sticking out the side. Now, I don't know how it made it through the atmosphere without those things falling off, but it was the right idea. It turns out Spielberg was inspired by an oil refinery he saw when they were filming one of the scenes in India, and then really tried to emphasize the lights on the UFOs. Again, it's more style than substance, but it looked cool. And then I was reading more about this movie, and it turns out one of the UFOs was actually just an oxygen mask with lights attached to it, and they liked it because it had this weird irregular shape. So I appreciate that they were playing around with the shape of the UFOs and not just doing the standard thing that people had been doing for years.
Yeah, they got to have some fun there, I think. And you point out, I think when we talked earlier, that there were things that people attach to the mothership in particular that had some significance or that referenced other productions.
Yeah, yeah. So the person who was designing the mothership had just finished working on Star Wars because they came out in the same year. And so, yeah, apparently you can go visit the model. It's in the Air and Space Museum in Dulles Airport, just outside of DC. And if you look carefully, you'll find a tiny little R2-D2 stuck on the side among a few other Star Wars references there. So that's kind of cute.
Very nice. With the whole question of having these protrusions or not, it's has to do with function. Like you say, in space, you're in vacuum. It's easier to develop this sort of skeletal spacecraft. But if you have to deal with atmosphere, that's when you see the streamlining. So like an aircraft is a highly instrumented object, but you wouldn't know it to look at it. Things are hidden that way. And the mothership, we don't really know what it's up to. Its size, its way through the atmosphere. So I'm happy to give it the protrusions. And I do enjoy, like you say, that that's reminiscent of the ISS or the Voyager spacecraft, actually, with all of the things sticking off. Yeah.
Which launched just after this movie came out, right? It was the late 70s. I'm blanking on the exact dates.
I think you're right that it was 77.
Yeah. It was around this time that the Voyager launched. And they're still out there, out beyond the edge of the solar system, still transmitting to that deep space array in California.
Indeed, they are. Well, why don't we stop it here? And we'll be back in just a minute with the most interesting part, I think, of this particular movie, the Of Its Time section.
All right, welcome back. So part of the reason I picked this movie is because I wanted to do something that was a little bit older. We've been doing some more recent works recently, and it's harder to do the Of Its Time when you're basically in the same time period as the show you're talking about. But this is 50 years old, so I thought we could dive into that a bit. So it was filmed in 1976, and as I said, it was really tough to put together, and they kind of had to rush it out into theaters, and it came out in November of 1977. Because Columbia was desperate not to go bankrupt. And indeed, this worked out great for them because it made, as John said, the third most amount of money that year. So they definitely made their money back. But it is a very 70s movie. And that's kind of the reason I wanted to talk about it. I don't know, John, where do you want to start?
I seem to be the one who's always picking up on the fashion, right?
Yes.
And I think this time it was just so overwhelming. You know, it came up on your list as well.
It was. Yeah. You forget how drab things were in the 70s and 80s. You know, there was just so much brown or tan, not a lot of bright colors. Although I was thinking about this as they were climbing the mountain and hiding from the helicopters. Maybe you want to be wearing a bunch of brown and tan drab clothing blend into the mountain so they can't see you. Maybe that worked out for them. And yeah, and just the technology too was very outdated. You see cameras and video recorders, even an old dishwasher. Everything just seemed ancient.
Of course, though, I know that you believe that the automobile industry achieved perfection in 1977 with the station wagon.
It's true. It's true. I do miss the station wagon. I can get up on my little pulpit here, and I really wish people would start making station wagons. At some point, they switched to SUVs and just abandoned the station wagon. And so they're really hard to find. As someone who loves the station wagon, the only ones they make nowadays are luxury vehicles, which I can't afford. But I've had station wagons my whole life, starting with the Saturn, which they don't make anymore, and now my falling apart Jetta, which they also don't make anymore. Yeah, it was real nostalgia seeing the station wagon here. Although they were not up to snuff in terms of seatbelt or car seat safety, I've got to say. I would never bring my 2-year-old kid and sit them on my lap in the front seat of a truck. Yeah, that's just a hazard for everybody involved.
Definitely. There have been ways in which automotive technology has improved over the years, but I can see your perspective there, you know, something that seats a few more people but drives more like a car.
Exactly. Yeah. You get it. I don't want to be that high off the ground. And SUVs honestly have less room than a station wagon, right? I love the giant trunk. I take my kids skiing on the weekends and I can cram their snowboards and skis in there because they don't have to fit into a tiny little trunk area. Sorry, I'm just going to keep going about station wagons. The seats fold down. So like in the past, I would stick my bike in there. You can transport large pieces of equipment. Yeah, there's just a lot to be said about the station wagon that we just don't have with the modern SUV.
Well, speaking about things you don't hear about much anymore, I think we have to talk about the alien abductions because
I
grew up in the 90s. You grew up in the 90s. It was not quite on every channel, but there was a lot of it being talked about. I mean, the X-Files was not like the lone outpost of aliens in the 90s. And these days, not so much.
Yeah, I can't say I've heard of a good alien abduction since the 90s, right? People just don't talk about this. So I kind of did a deep dive here because I'm really curious what happened to alien abductions. I thought maybe, oh, okay, maybe it's due to everyone having a phone in their pocket with cameras and video technology. Now people can see, oh, there's not any aliens out there because look, I took a picture of it and it's just an airplane. But no, that's not it. Actually, alien sightings have gone up since the mid-1990s, probably because people can now report them on the internet. It's just easier to report. So it's not that. People are still seeing UFOs. It's just that they're not getting abducted. And so, again, I couldn't find a good explanation for this. It seems to be perhaps cultural in nature, though. It was just the culture of its time, where in the past we would attribute strange occurrences to monsters or fairies. In the 80s and 90s, they attributed them to aliens. It might have been heightened by some of the stuff that was going on at the time. People were recognizing child abuse was happening and trying to explain it some way. Or, you know, the concerns about genetic engineering or reproductive technologies that were growing in interest at the time. So it seems like it ties in a little bit with the concept of the satanic panic, which was also happening at the time. People thought their children were being abused by satanic worshipers, which was not true, right? It was mostly just unfortunate run-of-the-mill child abuse by people that they already knew. But people were just freaking out about these things they couldn't understand, the stranger danger. And instead of just attributing them to other people who were doing horrible things, they attributed them to aliens. And then, yeah, this cultural phenomenon subsided for whatever reason. And by the 2000s, now we had the Twin Towers falling and you know, the wars in the Middle East and kind of the aliens went away. Although I read something that suggested maybe the alien abductions didn't go away. They just weren't reported to the widespread media because everyone could just talk to each other on the internet without getting mass media involved. So maybe they're still happening. We just don't hear about them because people are just talking to each other on the internet about them. I don't know. What do you think about this, John?
Yeah, there's the bubble effect, right? In that if you only talk to your own people on the internet, then you get to hear a lot of affirmation and whatnot. Back in the 90s, this was certainly around a lot, but it was not exactly credible, right? Like someone would show up on like a TV show, dare I say something like Jerry Springer, and they would talk about their abduction and they would get jeers and yelled at. And there was not a lot of affirmation there. So I can see why people would move towards that. I think you're right. There's just been a change in the culture a little bit. And it is interesting, I think. I think there's variations between different parts of the world for this, depending upon, you know, what those belief structures are for understanding the strange things that happen with consciousness. And the last time I remember this coming up in any kind of significant way was a few years ago when NASA had a little panel that they put together on UAPs, right? Which is the new term for UFOs, you know, these unidentified aerial phenomena. And we actually did something similar in Canada as well around the same time. The media made it sound a little bit like people were talking about aliens and freezers, but really it was about trying to understand things that had been seen in the sky. And one of the really great models for this, and I enjoy because this particular movie has a Frenchman as the great explainer. So the CNES, which is the French space agency, Le Centre d'études nationales spatiales, they actually have a program called, you know, GEPAN, which actually takes in, they ask people to give them their reports of anything weird that they saw in the sky or strange, like all of these things. And they get back to them publicly within 2 weeks as to what that thing is, if they can figure it out. And apparently that has helped quite a bit with this appearance of misinformation in France.
Interesting. Yeah, it seems like it's just going online a bit now. There was actually a recent Nova episode about UFOs, which I was like, come on, Nova, this isn't science. But they were talking about this team that was developing an app where people would report their UFO findings, and then they would either try to explain them, or if they couldn't, they'd sort of flag them for more follow-up research. So yeah, it seems like it's out there. People are reporting stuff, and people are trying to explain it where they can, but it's very much, I think, on the fringe. It's not in the public discourse anymore.
No. Definitely off to the edges. It's mostly Starlink, by the way. At least that's what we were seeing.
It's weird, true.
Lights in the sky.
Yeah. You know, I once saw the ISS, the International Space Station, orbit over top of me, and it was so bright and moving so fast. If I didn't know that I was looking at the ISS, I would have thought it was aliens. It was really striking.
And the old Iridium satellites, these are satellites that Motorola used to have for sat phones, they had really broad solar panels and they were angled such that sometimes you'd get a direct reflection of the sun. So they called those Iridium flares.
That's right. Yeah.
Or something, it just would brighten and then it would calm down again all of a sudden.
I mean, yeah, just go outside right after sunset when it's dark enough for you to see stars, but the sun hasn't quite fully set. And what happens is any satellite will capture those last, you know, rays of sunlight and make it look bright and moving quickly over the sky for those first hour after sunset. It's really cool to just go outside and take a look for some of these satellites. There are a lot of them up there nowadays.
Can't say you don't learn anything on Popcorn Science and that we don't give you homework.
So why don't we talk about the title of this movie? Because they don't ever try to explain it in the movie itself.
I know.
So it's called Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And we were joking that why didn't they make a sequel called Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind? Because that's not really a thing. I mean, this isn't a thing, but it was something developed by a famous ufologist, J. Allen Hynek, who was actually the Quoddy Marks science advisor for this film. And so he classified different encounters with extraterrestrials. So there's also close encounters of the first kind and close encounters of the second kind. The first being visual sightings of a UFO, and the second being some sort of physical effect associated with the UFO, but no actual sighting of an alien, which is what close encounters of the third kind is. And so if they took the aliens out, they would have to rename this movie to Close Encounters of the Second Kind, right? Which is maybe not as catchy. So, but yeah, he had this whole classification scheme of different encounters with aliens. And I wish they would at least touched upon that in the movie. It's weird that they didn't, because it's kind of a strange name for this movie.
Goodness. I mean, and they had the perfect time there. There's this point where there's an interrogation of Roy by Lecomte, and Lecomte is explaining to him, you know, about these sorts of encounters. You know, have you experienced this? Have you experienced that? It's the perfect spot. But he doesn't. He just says, you know, oh, you had a close encounter of some point. It's like, don't make that the title of the movie if you're not going to explain what it means.
Yeah, but yeah, so they did have this, they're called a ufologist, you know, on board helping out with the movie. I guess he worked on Project Blue Book, which is well known. I know of it from the X-Files. I guess it was some secret military thing they thought was related to aliens. And he said that even though the film is fiction, it's based for the most part on the known facts of the UFO mystery and certainly catches the flavor of the phenomenon, which is fair. But so they had this ufologist on board, but they also asked the United States Air Force and NASA if they wanted to cooperate on the film. And NASA was so incensed by this, they sent a 20-page letter to Spielberg telling him that releasing the film was dangerous. I guess they didn't want people thinking they were getting abducted by aliens. But Spielberg, in response, said, "I really found my faith when I heard that the government was opposed to the film. If NASA took the time to write me a 20-page letter, then I knew there must be something happening." So, yeah, it probably would have been better if they just didn't do that at all and fan the flames in that way.
It's interesting, though, like as recent as 2016, the idea of releasing the government's files on Area 51 and on aliens has been a part of presidential hopeful planks in the United States. So I don't know if that's recently been promised. I don't know that recently they've promised much of anything. But for a long time there was always quoting or chasing this vote, this group of people who thought that something was amiss.
Yeah, people are just really bad at keeping secrets, though, right? That's why, you know, all this government conspiracy stuff is just unbelievable to me. People are gossips, right? They like to talk to each other about things. They're not going to keep this a secret.
Well, you know that old joke, right? Like, three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead.
Yeah.
I'm not sure even then, to be honest with you.
So, yeah, I really don't think aliens have visited Earth. If they had, we would all know about it.
Yeah, I would think so too. So other interesting things about this particular movie that sort of set it in time. I mean, François Truffaut, right? Also somebody who I was very surprised to see in this movie. I have to admit, I remembered, you know, Richard Dreyfuss, but then it's like, oh my goodness, this celebrated French director. Is this like a favor to Spielberg or something? He just sort of shows up here.
Yeah, I guess Spielberg was surprised too. He wanted him to do this role, but he really didn't think he was going to accept it. So he was quite surprised when he agreed to it. And this is the only movie he's acted in that he didn't also direct. Unfortunately, he died not long after this movie came out, just 7 or 8 years later. But yeah, so this is his one sort of acting favor, perhaps, to Spielberg. I guess he didn't speak much English either at the time, which made it somewhat difficult for him to act in this movie. At some point, they had to like write his lines down on a piece of paper and like stick it to the wall so he could read it as he was acting. Another of the actors learned French in the process. He was the translator. And so they were able to communicate a bit. But yeah, it was kind of an odd situation for him to be in this movie.
Just adds to the overall oddness, I think. One more little piece. Someone who looks like and who we associate walking out of like almost like this film noir type of world.
Right, right. I thought he was great, though. He did a good job in the role.
Oh, yeah, it worked out well. And it added to the confusion, you know, just like the little statements, you know, without anything to them. Like, you know, I wish I could be you, Roy. It's like, why? What's going to happen?
Yeah, there were a lot of little statements kind of mingled throughout the movie that really set it in its time, too. Just to highlight a few of them, they had a little USS Enterprise model in Roy's house, you know, calling back to Star Trek, which was about a decade old at that point. He was playing Days of Our Lives in the background, which is one of the most long-running soap operas, which started in 1965, and it continues to the present day. There's even a Walter Cronkite reference, the famous CBC Evening News anchor, who was in that role from 1962. To 1981. And then even I noticed on the crates at the evil government facility in Devil's Tower, they had Lockheed on the side. And I'm familiar with Lockheed Martin as an aerospace company, but I guess this was before they merged with Martin, which was in 1994. So anyways, all these, there are a lot of little pieces that really set it in the 70s that you would never see today.
Absolutely. And just think it's getting to the point now where you recognize the film, just the film that they use, the backdrops that they use feel pretty dated, and other little techniques that have gotten better. Like the fact that Richard Dreyfuss, whenever he expresses any emotion at all, he seems to be just like literally dripping as if they dumped a bucket of water on his head. So much flop sweat.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, they don't make movies the same way. Even the beginning of the movie is quite dated, right? It opens up and it's just a black screen with the actors and the director's names on it. No flashy opening, no opening credits, just black screen with names. You just don't see that anymore. Although I think Blade Runner opened in a very similar way. So it was quite common back then.
There were definitely parts of this that reminded me a little bit of 2001, right?
Yes, yeah.
And more, I think, the style of filmmaking and the choice of shots and just the way things were set up. Like, we've talked in the past about how 2001 influenced, say, Star Wars in terms of the set design. Here, it seems like more the cinematography, the direction just reminded me of that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, though, this is one of Spielberg's first movies. He had come to prominence just 2 years prior with Jaws. So I think he was still trying to find his style a bit. We recently talked about Jurassic Park, and I thought that was a much better movie than this one. So I guess he learned something in the 15 years between Close Encounters and Jurassic Park. Because, yeah, I think there's still some issues here that got tightened up in his later work.
Well, what do you think, Catherine? Is there anything else you want to hit in terms of its time before we move on to the ratings?
Just one thing, because it's a callback to one of our previous episodes, and that they actually showed a McDonald's in this movie, and it said 24 billion served. And I was like, well, you know, that's a heck of a lot less than the 65 trillion they had in The Fifth Element. So, you know, I've got to do my math again to see if it makes sense.
Well, that's true. And you pointed out also that there's a bathroom here that makes an appearance.
That's right.
With a scared person. Also, yeah. Like Jurassic Park.
Yeah, so we also just did Jurassic Park, and there's that famous scene where the person runs into the bathroom to avoid the dinosaur and then gets eaten anyways. I actually noticed there was some guy who was like running away from the aliens into, you know, an outhouse there on the Devil's Tower site. So he fared a lot better than the guy in Jurassic Park, though. None of the aliens came down and tried to eat him.
Dodged a bullet there.
Yep. All right, well, let's wrap this up with our ratings then. We'll be back in just a second. Okay, welcome back. So this is the portion of the episode where we rate the movie on three areas on a scale of 1 to 5. So we rate it in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence over time, and how does it hold up? So we'll start with scientific accuracy. John, what did you give this movie?
I gave it a 2, and I think that's a generous 2, I have to say. Like, I felt coming out of it, there were some things in there that were scientific. But the more I talk about it with you, the less and less I think of it. Like, it feels like they're like little islands separated by gulfs of vibes. And yeah, I'm going to stick with my 2, but it's a generous 2.
Yeah, I agree. And talking about this now with you, John, I actually had to revise my grade down to 1.5. I mean, it's no Core. It's no Fifth Element. We've seen worse movies than this, but it's not good. They don't try to explain anything. Yeah, again, just more of the style than the substance. I would have liked a bit more exposition here. All right. How about its influence?
So I think we might disagree a little bit here, and I want to explain why I'm going with another 2 here. So certainly this did well at the box office. And like I said earlier, I almost felt like I was watching like 15 simultaneous X-Files episodes. So it definitely has imprinted itself on other properties. But at the same time, it just doesn't feel memorable in the same way that other films that we have, like all I remember is The Mashed Potato and Devil's Tower, right? And it's just not as iconic as some of the other films, even some of the other spacey films that Spielberg has made. Like it's no E.T., right? And so I feel like even though it has had a bit of an influence, it's just been overshadowed by other things and it hasn't aged well. So, although we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah. I had originally given this a 4 because I did think it was influential for future work. Like I said, you know, you can see a lot of the tricks that Spielberg did in later works. So they're influenced. And I did remember it. I mean, this is an almost 50-year-old movie and I still remember seeing it, although I clearly blanked on a lot of the details. But I think I'm going to revise it down to a 3 because you're right. I think there are other movies that have had a stronger influence on our culture. You know, if I were to ask any of my 20-something students, I'm sure they've never heard of this movie, whereas talk about Star Wars and everyone knows what you're talking about, right? So kind of middle of the road, I would say. I think it has had some influence on sci-fi movies in the past 50 years, but not as much as other movies.
That's a fair point.
All right. So lastly, how do you think it holds up over time?
Yeah, I'm going to go with 2s across the board here. Doesn't look laughable, right? They did spend a buck or 2 on this one. But at the same time, there's so much of it that feels like a much older movie. Looking at some of the special effects, looking at their use of backdrops, partially because they have so many scenes at night and you just can't film actors and the background at night together. I get that, but it makes it feel almost like a movie from the 50s or the 60s. Mm. So in some ways, it even seems more dated than it really is. So I'll give them some points for the alien spacecraft and whatnot, but yeah, it's pretty dated.
Yeah, I also gave it a 2. I don't think it holds up pretty well. It's clearly a movie from the 70s. Special effects are clearly quite dated. And when you compare it to another comparable movie from 1977, Star Wars, I think it holds up a lot better. It's more timeless, whereas this one is clearly firmly in the 70s with both special effects and the look of the movie. So I don't think it holds up particularly well. All right, any final thoughts before we wrap things up?
No, take us to the end in your station wagon, Catherine.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us this week. Until next time, da 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 da. See you later.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.